Welcome to Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers with true crime masters and New York Times bestselling authors Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge. In this episode, The Last Days of John Lennon, Part 1, Casey and Dave take you inside the murder of the iconic Beatle and reveal the events that put him on a deadly collision course with an obsessed fan. And now, Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge.
December 6th, 1980. A bespectacled young man sits on a smoke-filled airplane. He pulls out his own Camel and lights it up. It's 1980, and not only could you still smoke on a plane, you could also easily smuggle a gun. And that's just what this man did. In his luggage was a .38 caliber snub-nosed revolver. He was on his way to New York City to use it to kill an icon. His plane touches down at LaGuardia International Airport in New York after a long, smooth flight from Honolulu. He'd said goodbye to his wife, but she expected he'd be back. He knew that he wouldn't be. The overweight, 25-year-old nobody grabbed his luggage from the carousel and hailed a cab. He stepped in. "I'm a recording engineer. I work with John Lennon and Paul McCartney," he told the cabbie. The cabbie ignored him, like everyone else in his life. Pulls out a baggie of Coke, sprinkles a bump on his wrist, and snorts it. The cab pulls up to a YMCA on 63rd Street in Midtown. "I'm Mark David Chapman," he tells the cabbie. "Remember my name." Soon, the whole world would know that name.
Chapman is still raging over an interview that John Lennon gave to a reporter when he was just 26 years old and at the height of his Beatles fame. A British reporter had asked Lennon what his thoughts were about fame and organized religion. "Christianity will go," Lennon told her. "It'll vanish and shrink. I needn't argue that. I'm right and I'll be proved right. We're more popular than Jesus now." We're more popular than Jesus. Lennon didn't actually mean that. He's referring to the absurd notion that kids were packing record stores to buy their albums and not going to church. The British press doesn't even raise much of an eyebrow. It's just John being John.
Now, this religious controversy, I know you don't want to say too much about it, but does it worry you that it's going to boil up when you get to the States?
Well, it worries me, yes. I hope everything will be all right in the end of the day.
But when the interview was reprinted in an American magazine in 1966... it sparks a firestorm. The Beatles are about to embark on a concert tour across America. Two radio DJs in Birmingham, Alabama, seize upon the interview, and they mobilize their teenage listeners to denounce the band, and especially John Lennon.
"This is Tommy Charles. If you, as an American teenager, are offended by statements from a group of foreign singers which strike at the very basis of our existence as God-fearing, patriotic citizens, then we urge you to take your Beatle records, pictures, and souvenirs to the pickup points about to be named, and on the night of the Beatles' appearance in Memphis, August 19th, they will be destroyed in a huge public bonfire at a place to be named soon. Stay tuned to Wacky for further developments."
I think the Beatles are a real talented group, but I think that they need to watch what they say, because they're in such a position that a lot of teenagers really think of them as something really big. And when they say things like that, some teenagers are going to just believe anything they say.
26-year-old John Lennon sits in a wooden chair inside his room on the 27th floor of the Astor Towers in Chicago, fighting to gain control of his shaking hands. "John, do you realize the implications of this?" Beatles manager Brian Epstein asks the young rock star. "This isn't about rescuing your own reputation. This is about saving the group's tour. It's even more important than that. My fear, John, is that you might be assassinated." Lennon places his glass on the coffee table, puts his face in his trembling hands, and weeps. Epstein forces Lennon to confront the issue with reporters.
"No, but I'm not saying that we're better or greater or comparing us with Jesus Christ as a person or God as a thing or whatever it is. You know, I just said what I said and it was wrong or was taken wrong and now it's all this."
The Beatles' 1966 American tour has become a disaster. Just 2 years after taking the U.S. and the world by musical storm with their historic debut on The Ed Sullivan Show, the pop stars find themselves facing a public relations nightmare, complete with angry threats and ghoulish predictions. the Beatles fan club is flooded with stacks of hate mail. Among the piles are several letters written by self-proclaimed psychics. One predicts that the Beatles would all perish in a plane crash. Another writes that John will be shot while on tour in the U.S.
We interviewed Paul McCartney in 2019 for our book, The Last Days of John Lennon, co-authored by James Patterson. He reflected on the controversy and expressed his concern for his bandmate. Because John's quote was taken out of context, it was widely misunderstood, McCartney told us. He was actually making a point about church congregations shrinking. Therefore, I felt bad for John during the whole episode. Now, during a press conference in 1966, Paul was asked about the controversy.
Do you feel that Americans are out to get you, that this is all developing into something of a witch hunt?
No, we thought it might be that kind of thing. I think a lot of people in England did, because there's this thing about, you know, when America gets violent, gets very hung up on a thing, it tends to have this sort of Ku Klux Klan thing around it.
In fact, the KKK was on alert and on the hunt for the Beatles. When the band takes the stage in Washington, D.C., a group of men steps out of their cars in the parking lot, dressed in red, white, and green robes, the colors of Maryland's Ku Klux Klan. They've been planning something dark for days. Threats against Lennon become all too real when the Beatles arrive in Memphis, Tennessee, for the band's only shows in the Deep South. As the charter plane touches down, George Harrison offers a bit of gallows humor. "Send John out first," he snickers. "He's the one they want." "You might as well paint a target on me," Lennon replies.
In fact, John is the first Beatle to descend the plane stairway onto the tarmac. Despite stifling heat beating down from the mid-August sun, John wears a black coat and black shirt with sunglasses. He looks like he's about to attend a funeral instead of performing a rock concert. The first real sign of trouble occurs as the Beatles are escorted by police into a specially armored van for the drive to the newly built Mid-South Coliseum, where hooded Ku Klux Klansmen patrol the parking lot. One hooded racist even gives an interview to a local television reporter, offering a clear threat to the British rock stars.
"The Ku Klux Klan, being a religious order, is going to come out here the night that they appear at the Coliseum here, and we're going to demonstrate with different ways and tactics to stop this performance. The Klan is going to come out here because we're the only organization that will come out and make a stop to these accusations. This is nothing but blasphemy, and we're going to try to stop it any terror way we can, but it's going to stop. We're known as a terror organization. I think we have
a terror organization.
We have ways and means to stop this if this is going to be the case. Yes.
What ways and means?
Well, I don't want to say this, but there'll be a lot of surprises Monday night, I believe, when they get here.
On the ride into Memphis, John, Paul, Ringo, and George are all ordered to lie down on the floor of the armored van for fear that a sniper might attack them. The lads try to treat the threats as folly, but each Beatle is truly fearful. The world was still haunted by the assassination of President John F. Kennedy less than 3 years before in Dallas. "There was always an edge in America," Ringo said later. "We knew they did have guns." Before the first show, someone traveling with the band gets an anonymous telephone call with an ominous prediction that one of the Beatles will be shot on stage. But the Beatles soldier on, singing and smiling their way through their first show at 4 p.m. on August 18, 1966 without incident, as they rip through a string of hits before a large crowd made up mostly of screaming teenage girls. At the start of the second show that evening, just after George sang the first verse of the song "If I Needed Someone" off their acclaimed Rubber Soul album, a loud popping noise echoes through the concert hall. George and Paul immediately jerk sideways toward Lennon, whose heart nearly stops.
John believes he's just been shot, and the others do too. But the Beatles' frontman doesn't feel any pain, and he's still standing, so he keeps playing anyway. Knowing that their leader is okay, McCartney and Harrison keep performing too, without interruption. The noise is actually the result of a cherry bomb that's been lobbed by two teenagers from the upper balcony. Other kids toss fruit, firecrackers, and used flashbulbs onto the stage. But now the Beatles are in battle mode. They jam and they shake their heads in a mad frenzy, like it's the last time they'll appear in concert together in public. "I thought they'd kill me," John later tells a reporter, because they take things so seriously here in the U.S. I mean, they shoot you, and then they realize it wasn't that important. The Beatles had played 19 shows in 14 cities during the summer of 1966. They're exhausted and they're bitter at the attitudes and treatment from the religious right and the American media that is piling on in an effort to generate sensational headlines. After the San Francisco gig, the bandmates make a pact to quit touring altogether, and they retreat to the safer confines of the studio. The decision causes an even bigger uproar than John's comments about Jesus. Is Beatlemania dead? A writer from Time magazine wonders aloud.
Fortunately, for music fans around the world, the Beatles weren't dead, at least not yet. More classic albums will follow, including the band's opus, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. The Beatles hold their last public performance on January 30th, 1969, on the rooftop of Apple Records at 3 Savile Row in London. American record executive Ken Mansfield now works directly for the Beatles. As the U.S. manager of Apple Records, he's constantly jetting between Los Angeles and London to help aid the band in its discovery of new artists. Mansfield is witness to the breakup of the band following John's decision to bring his girlfriend, avant-garde artist Yoko Ono, into their recording sessions. We interviewed Mansfield about his experience.
Things really changed because you knew in every meeting, everything we did, Yoko was there, and there was a tension because of that, and because she had broke, they broke the golden rule where there's always just the four of them. You always had this feeling, though, no matter what I said to John, that it really went through Yoko and then came back to John and then came back to me. So it was kind of filtered, but the same token, she was very standoffish. She made you feel like she was better than you in a way, but she never said anything like that or showed that. You just got this feeling, but she was very kind to me. She approved everything I ever wanted to do for John, so I can't really say, you know, I had no bad experience with her. So
which of the guys was probably the most resentful of Yoko? Was it Paul?
I would think so, yeah. And I think George had maybe a deeper response to that in a way. I think it drew him a little inward from the whole thing happening. I just don't think he liked it.
The fighting between Paul and John, or he didn't like Yoko's intrusion on the band?
Oh, that was it. Absolutely. Yeah. Nobody liked that.
Even Ringo was...
Ringo was like... I used to joke a lot of times Ringo would come into the office, go to work and leave at 5 o'clock. You know, he was just kind of went along with things a lot. He was... if you had two guys in favor of something, then Ringo would always go kind of with the majority. He was just kind of easygoing about things like that.
Mansfield, who later wrote a great book about his time with the Beatles, is also there on the rooftop, just feet from the band during their last and perhaps most defining moment. The concert almost doesn't happen.
Was John nervous to play live again, or was it just kind of muscle memory? He knew he could kick ass when he got out there.
You know, I can't go inside his head. I just don't think he was... This is a personal opinion. I just don't think the band thing was as important to him at one time with Yoko. Now that Yoko was, you know, part of it. And there was a lot of friction. In fact, what I was told, now this is secondhand, that I went up to the... They took one of the office, like a dressing room, before they just were going to go out. They were going to go out like at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And somebody had me go up and give... George a message or something. When I walked in, they were like really, like they were nervous or something. And I thought they were just nervous about playing again. And later on, I realized it because they just were so much tension that they weren't really sure they were going to go on the roof. In fact, the person had told me when they got to the doorway that they hadn't decided yet. And that John said, you know, like just go do it, you know, get it over with.
Yeah, right.
And, the roof is the most amazing thing in my life because it really was another day at the office. There was always something going on around there. It was just, you know, and you didn't think that much about it. And they came out and they started playing, and I witnessed the tension that was going on with them. But when they started playing, John and Paul looked over at each other at one point and you went, yeah, this is us. We're a good band. We've been together forever. We've been friends, and this is why we're successful, because we're a good band. And if you watch that tape, you can just see how they're just rocking again like they did at the Cavern.
But the once mighty walls of Applecore are now crumbling around them. In May 1969, John Lennon plans an escape of his own. He and his girlfriend Yoko Ono decide to stage a bed-in for peace in the belly of the beast, President Richard Nixon's America. They hope to present Nixon with two acorns to bury for peace. Their grand plans are dashed when John is denied a visa to enter the United States because of a drug conviction in 1968. It's a cloud that will continue to hover over the couple for the next decade. At the time of the drug bust, John and Yoko are staying in Ringo's apartment at 34 Montague Square, about a mile from Abbey Road. Ringo had rented the apartment to Paul McCartney in the past, as well as Jimi Hendrix, who leased the place for 3 months until getting evicted by Ringo the year before. On the morning of October 18th, 1968, the couple is sleeping in skimpy nightshirts together in bed when John hears a loud knock on the door, followed by a woman's voice. "I've got a message for you," she says. "Who is it?" "You're not the postman," John replies. "No, it's personal." At first, Lennon thinks that he and Yoko are about to be attacked by the Cray brothers, a pair of infamous London gangsters and stone-cold killers known for their violent shakedowns of business owners and entertainers. He then reaches for his glasses and sees a police officer standing by the window outside. Suddenly, the door handle begins to turn, and there is pressure coming from the outside. But the apartment is locked up tight. Yoko jumps out of bed and runs into the bathroom to fetch some clothes. "Ring the lawyer quick," John tells her. Lennon knows why the police have come knocking. He had been forewarned by a reporter friend a few weeks before. "They're coming to get you," the friend told him. John and Yoko took the advice seriously and scrubbed the apartment for drugs. "I cleaned the house out because Jimi Hendrix had lived there before in this apartment," Lennon recalled later. "I'm not stupid. I went through the whole damn house." The couple refuses to open the front door to police. Officers rush around the back and try to force their way in through a window. John hears the ruckus and runs toward the window, using all of his strength to hold it tight. "Read me your warrant," Lennon demands. "If you don't let us in, we'll break down the front door," Sergeant Norman Pilcher shouts back. John doesn't want the cops to destroy Ringo's place, so he gives in and reluctantly allows them inside.
Pilcher pushes his way past John and Yoko, trailed by a plainclothes detective, two detective constables, two drug-sniffing dog handlers, and a policewoman. It's an incredible show of force, and hungry reporters and photographers who had been tipped off to the raid are standing outside to capture all the drama. Pilcher and his team can't find any outward sign of drug use. There are no pills or marijuana lying around the apartment, but that doesn't stop him. He's come here to slap handcuffs on John Lennon, and that's what he's going to do. The detective has become famous in Britain for staging celebrity drug busts. He's already arrested Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, and Donovan, but Lennon would surely be his prized pelt. After a half hour, the drug-sniffing dogs named Yogi and Boo Boo arrive and race through the apartment like they're chasing wild rabbits. Soon, loud barking echoes throughout the rooms as the canines zero in on small traces of cannabis found in a cigarette roller, a film can, and a binoculars case. Norman Pilcher can't hide his gap-toothed smile. John and Yoko are taken out of the apartment, and they're perp-walked through a sea of reporters before they're stuffed into a squad car and driven to the police station where they're formally charged. At first, John breathes a sigh of relief over the fact that all police could find were small grains of marijuana, or about a half ounce of pot. He agrees to plead guilty and pay a small fine as long as charges are dropped against Yoko. Although she's spared a criminal record, the ordeal has a tremendous impact on her health. Yoko is pregnant with John's child but suffers a miscarriage a short time later. In a karmic twist, Detective Norman Pilcher will also pay. A few years later, he's thrown into jail for 4 years after being convicted of perjury and conspiracy to pervert the court of justice in another case. You poisoned the wells of criminal justice, the judge tells him, and you set about it deliberately. But in 1969, the drug conviction that was triggered by Pilcher sticks to Lennon like glue.
John Lennon had pushed for peace, but peace is still out of reach in the jungles of Vietnam, on college campuses from Connecticut to California, and also along a winding private road called CeeLo Drive in Hollywood, where a small group of murderous hippies are about to commit a crime that will shock the world. Ordered by a maniacal self-proclaimed messiah named Charles Manson, three young killers armed with a gun and knives enter the rented home of Hollywood director Roman Polanski and his pregnant starlet wife Sharon Tate. Polanski is fresh off his smash hit Rosemary's Baby, starring Mia Farrow. He's working on a new film in Europe, and he has left his beautiful young wife in the care of friends. Hairdresser to the stars Jay Sebring, a screenwriter, and his girlfriend, coffee heiress Abigail Folger. One of the killers, Tex Watson, cuts the phone line to the house and then shoots the property's caretaker four times in the chest with a .22 caliber revolver. As he enters the home, Watson finds the screenwriter asleep on the couch. He is startled awake with a kick to the head. "I'm the devil," Watson tells him, "and I'm here to do the devil's business." Watson's two female companions, Susan Atkins and Patricia Krenwinkle, search the home for more victims. They find Sebring, Folger, and Sharon Tate, who, 9 months pregnant, struggles down the stairs. When Sebring complains about how they're treating her, Watson shoots him and stabs him 7 times. "Totally destroy everyone. Be as gruesome as you can," Manson had instructed the killers earlier that night. Abigail Folger is stabbed 28 times. Her boyfriend, the screenwriter, is sliced 51 times and is left virtually unrecognizable and saturated with blood. Sharon Tate pleads for the life of her unborn child, but the killers show no mercy. She's stuck with a knife repeatedly before she dies along with her baby. Susan Atkins smears the word pig on the front door of the house in Tate's blood. 2 more people will be killed in similar fashion by Manson and his followers the next night. During the course of the investigation, prosecutors learn that Manson's murder spree is partially inspired by the Beatles' White Album, most notably McCartney's hard rock song Helter Skelter. The words Helter Skelter are found written in the victim's blood at the second crime scene, the murders of Lino and Rosemary LaBianca. "This music is bringing on a revolution," the wild-eyed demonic Manson says later. The Beatles know what's happening, in the sense that the subconscious knows.
Charles Manson uses the words Helter Skelter to describe what he predicts will be a coming race war that's going to rip all the cities apart. Manson doesn't just co-opt the McCartney song for his own fiendish purposes. He also finds hidden messages in other Beatles songs like Blackbird, Piggies, Rocky Raccoon, and Lennon's Revolution 9. John's suggestive anthem particularly rattles around inside Manson's head as the cult leader claims that he can hear machine gun fire in the background. The band is disturbed by the association between their music and the Manson murders. Ringo was friends with Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate and feels terrified. George is seething that the long-haired, bearded look the Beatles made popular is now being represented by a murderer and an enemy of peace. Paul calls the twisted interpretation horrific. John fears that Manson, like countless others, is reading too much into Beatles lyrics, and that has led to tragic consequences. "He's like any other Beatle fan who reads mysticism into it," Lennon says. "We used to have a laugh about it when some intellectual wants to see something in it. We also took seriously some parts of the role, but I don't know what Helter Skelter has to do with knifing anybody." Charles Manson isn't the only crazed fan on a quest to discover hidden meanings in Beatles music.
During John's recording of Imagine at his Tittenhurst estate in the English countryside, one guest that shows up uninvited to his home is a young, handsome American drifter named Kurt Claudio. He sends a telegram to the house that reads, "Hi, I'm coming over. I'll be there soon. Claudio." He's been writing letters to John for a while now, and sometimes refers to himself as Lennon in a bizarre one-sided correspondence. The drifter has convinced himself that the former Beatle is trying to communicate to him through his music. When he arrives wearing a mangy coat and matted down brown, scraggly hair, Lennon's estate staff wants to call in the police, fearing that it could be a Manson-style attack on the world's most famous rock star. But John is very relaxed, and he agrees to have a chat with the troubled intruder, who has come in search of some kind of universal truth.
Don't confuse the songs with your own life. I mean, they might have relevance to your own life, you know, but a lot of things do. So we met, you know, I'm just a guy, man, who writes songs.
During the exchange, John has a deep look of concern on his face. He's not uneasy about his own safety. Instead, he's worried about Claudio's mental state. John looks at him like how a distressed parent would view a wayward child. He feels empathy and a responsibility for all of his young fans, and he truly cares about the man who flew all the way from California hoping to share a few moments with his idol. John invites Claudio inside and treats him to a hearty breakfast. Lennon and Yoko then move to the United States, where John becomes a major political force and also a thorn in the FBI's side.
John Lennon, Dr. Moore. 15,000 protesters packed the smoke-filled Chrysler Arena in Ann Arbor, Michigan, to rally for a man now serving a 10-year prison sentence for handing two marijuana cigarettes to an undercover policeman. The prisoner is poet John Sinclair, and he's already spent 2 years behind bars in two different maximum security correctional facilities. Sinclair is listening to the rally live thanks to a secret telephone hookup in his jail cell. John and Yoko stand backstage wearing matching leather jackets, waiting for their cue to go on. Lennon feels a kinship with the imprisoned Sinclair after getting pinched himself for marijuana by the corrupt cop Pilcher back in England, and he's been inspired to write a song about the poet's plight. Embedded among the thousands of long-haired protesters squeezed into the arena are undercover agents working for the FBI. They're taking mental notes to send to their brooding boss, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, back in Washington. So far, there's nothing to report that they haven't heard before from these anti-government agitators. The agents do their best not to break cover while trying hard not to inhale the pot smoke wafting from a convoy of joints getting passed around them. "We should put them all in jail," one agent whispers to himself. The rally's supposed to end at midnight, but it carries on for 12 hours. It's now 3:30 a.m., and the government spies crane their necks for a better view of the stage as two familiar faces appear at the end of the show. It's John Lennon and Yoko Ono. Suddenly, the agents realize that this isn't going to be like any protest rally they've infiltrated before. The ex-Beatle is not just a musician. He's become an influential world figure and an intellectual force to be reckoned with. The entire crowd is hanging on Lennon's every word as he straps on a Dobro steel stringed guitar with Yoko by his side.
We came here not only to help John and to spotlight what's going on, but also to show and to say to all of you that apathy isn't it, and that we can do something. Okay, so flower power didn't work, so what? We start again.
Lennon begins to strum the opening chords to his song John Sinclair, which has a Delta blues feel to it and sounds like it was composed and performed in a prison yard somewhere. "It ain't fair, John Sinclair, in the stir for breathing air," he sings as Yoko taps the bongo while following along with the music. If he had been a soldier man shooting gooks in Vietnam, if he was in the CIA selling dope and making hay, he'd be free, they'd let him be, breathing air like you and me. The undercover agents are committing every lyric to memory, and it all spells trouble. The next day, the FBI men return to the Bureau's field office in Detroit. No longer are they wearing ripped jeans and concert t-shirts. The agents have shed their hippie disguises and are now dressed in drab, cheap suits paid for by government salaries. Clack, clack, clack go the typewriters as they bang away on the keys to create and compile their report. The heading on the dossier reads confidential. One agent transcribes Lennon's entire song in his report and also mentions that organizers have netted $36,000 from the rally. Another FBI man, clearly a music fan, decides to critique Lennon's performance, believing that it may somehow help with their investigation. The song John Sinclair is lacking Lennon's usual standards, the agent writes. Yoko can't even remain on key. Sinclair's supporters have been lobbying for his release for 2 years, but after Lennon's appearance in Ann Arbor, the Michigan Supreme Court immediately rules that the state's marijuana laws are unconstitutional. They order the poet released from prison just 3 days later. Sinclair steps out of jail and into the waiting, warm arms of his wife and young daughter. He thanks John and Yoko for his freedom. Lennon's political influence is not lost on J. Edgar Hoover or President Richard Nixon. Hey, Casey. Like our fans who tune in here on Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers, we're all about truth. Working on our projects, I need a boost sometimes. I love my coffee, but I'm really loving these true lifestyle drinks.
Me too, Dave. There are 6 different flavors for every activity. They're gluten and GMO-free, organic, vegan, and there's no artificial sweeteners or additives. They're clean, and they contain all sorts of vitamins and nutrients, and they're damn tasty.
You know, True's founder, Jack McNamara, is a former pro hockey player, and he created True because he was looking for healthy energy drinks that wouldn't make you crash. I've been loving Energy, the Orange Mango Wake Up Blend, as well as Focus, the Apple Kiwi Brain Blend. Jack and his team have scientifically engineered some game-changing beverages, and I'm working several of them into my daily routine.
And I'm making them part of my lifestyle, too. True Drinks for true crime fans. Go to drinktrue.com and use the code SAINTS to get 30% off your purchase. Now, back to Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers. John and Yoko have been living in the United States since August 1971. They've moved here from England because Lennon is disgusted by the racial slurs thrown at Yoko, and he's also angry at the British government for its treatment of Catholics in Northern Ireland, where sectarian violence has set Belfast ablaze. The couple is granted B2 visas, which allow them to stay in the United States for 6 months. They settle in New York City, where Yoko had once lived as a struggling artist. She convinces her husband that they can live in relative anonymity among the greatest artists, writers, and progressive thinkers on the planet. New York City feels like the center of the creative world, Lennon tells a friend. In the time of Rome, you wanted to be in Rome, not in the suburbs. In the time of the 70s, you want to be in New York City. I like New Yorkers because they have no time for the niceties of life. They're like me in this. They're naturally aggressive. They don't believe in wasting time. Lennon stays under the U.S. government's radar during his first few months living in New York. But all of that changes in December 1971 when he orchestrates the prison release of John Sinclair. The former Beatle is now an enemy of the state. President Nixon mobilizes the FBI and deploys an army of federal agents to destroy the leading members of the peace movement. Nixon is becoming more paranoid with each day, and Lennon is now in the president's gunsight. John's name is added to a growing list of Nixon's enemies that also includes newsman Dan Rather, Senator Ted Kennedy, and even Jets star quarterback Joe Namath. For those on the list, it's a badge of honor, but it also sparks fear.
Nixon's enemies point to the shooting deaths of 2 Black Panther Party leaders in Chicago as proof that the government is willing to liquidate its political opponents. Leading anti-war figures shudder when thinking about how the FBI targeted Black Panther leader Fred Hampton for 3 years before he's killed in a hail of gunfire when police raid his apartment on Chicago's West Side. Officers fire between 82 and 99 bullets, while only one shot comes from inside the apartment. Another Panther leader, Mark Clark, is also killed and silenced forever. People like John Lennon can't stop thinking to themselves, will I be next? Government agents begin tracking Lennon's movements and following his money. FBI agents disguised as workmen enter Lennon's apartment building and head for the basement, where they place a wiretap on his phone. Lennon tries to make a phone call and hears a crackling noise that wasn't there before. Someone's listening, he tells himself. Feeling spooked, he grabs Yoko's hand and asks her to go for a walk. The walls are closing in, and he's in desperate need of fresh air. As they climb down the steps of their apartment at 105 Bank Street and head west, John notices a car pull off the curb and follow close behind. Two men in suits are staring out the car windows at them.
They want us to see them, John tells his wife. They want us to know that they're watching. Lennon's heart is racing now. He and Yoko keep their usual routine. They don't try to run or evade the FBI surveillance team. They continue to stroll arm in arm, browsing through a bookstore and then visiting a neighborhood diner for something to eat, while the government car, unmarked yet in plain sight, is double parked with the engine running close by. John tries to keep his cool, as he doesn't want to scare his wife. Later that night, he receives a visitor to their apartment. Lennon pulls him close and whispers in his friend's ear, "If anything happens to me or Yoko, just remember, it's not an accident." Later, John and Yoko hear a knock on their apartment door. They don't open it. The knocking continues, and it gets louder now. "It's Pilcher all over again," Lennon whispers to Yoko. "Who is it?" Yoko asks. "It's immigration," the man on the other side hollers. Instead of busting down the door, the government agent slips a letter underneath the door and walks away smiling. John picks up the letter and tears open the envelope. He holds it up to the light in the entryway and reads along with Yoko. The news is shocking. "I'm getting deported," he says. John and Yoko drop the letter to the floor and they look at each other. What are we going to do?
They're even sort of changing their own rules to get us, you know, just because we're peaceniks, really.
Yeah. Do you think it's because of your anti-war action and not your marijuana conviction, then?
Well, I mean, let's say that a few friends of ours in the pop business have exactly the same conviction as me and are allowed to come and go as free as they like.
Meanwhile, surveillance on Lennon's apartment continues. Now, agents posing as cyclists stand across Bank Street pretending to fix their tires. They watch and record everyone who enters and leaves the building. John and Yoko's phone line is still bugged, and now their lawyer's phone is too. Their lawyer, concerned about the bug, begins to hold all his phone conversations in Yiddish. John and Yoko's friends grow increasingly concerned about their safety. "I was expecting him to be put in a bag at any moment and hauled off to the airport, or even to be assassinated," their choreographer pal Dan Richter says later. "It was scary." Lennon's lawyer recruits his celebrity friends to testify on his behalf so that he can remain in the U.S. as a permanent resident. Lennon reaches out to legendary actress Gloria Swanson, who's become a fan of John's, as well as best-selling author Norman Mailer and their close friend Geraldo Rivera. We interviewed Rivera about his friendship with Lennon.
"I got the call from John telling me that the United States was trying to get him deported and asking whether I would, vouch for them in essence. And I said, of course, my goodness, I'd be honored. And now it's a slam dunk. In those days, though, when you had the Nixon White House as your opposition, it was intimidating. There's no doubt about it.
You know, then you get put on the list, Geraldo, you know?
They wanted John out of the country. Nixon was already wounded by Watergate, but, a wounded snake can still bite you."
Sure. exactly. When you did testify, your rational thought with regard to why John should be allowed to stay in the country, was it something that was complex or something completely elementary in terms of trying to get the board or the folks that you were talking to agree with your position?
The problem was the law was pretty specific. If you have a drug conviction, a felony level conviction, you are an undesirable alien.
Which was complete bullshit. I mean,
it was total bullshit.
Yeah.
It was a marijuana bust that he pled guilty to just to get rid of it because they were so busy.
Right.
So it was like a big nothing, but it was enough
legally to bar him. So it was an obstacle, but there was one out. If we could prove that he was an important contributor to the well-being of American society, I may not be wording it right, that could trump the technicality of the felony guilty plea. So my role, which I accepted with honor and relish, was to state how important they had been in the cause of the deinstitutionalization of the developmentally disabled.
Wow.
So by talking about the money they raised and the attention they attracted to the cause, we helped sway the immigration judge.
Lennon wins his battle in court. He can stay in the United States permanently, but his trouble has only just begun. He goes back in the studio again, this time with his close friend, producer Phil Spector. During their sessions, Lennon notices that Spector is acting odder than usual and is becoming increasingly paranoid. The producer shows up at the studio with a pistol tucked into a shoulder holster. "Hey man, I hate fucking guns, all right?" Lennon tells him. "Those bullets better be all blanks." Spector then draws his weapon like a movie cowboy, waves it above his head, and pulls the trigger. One loud gunshot echoes through the studio as the ceiling tile crashes down. The gunshot startles Lennon. "Listen, Phil, if you're gonna kill me, kill me. But don't fuck with my ears. I need them." "I was only kidding," Spector responds mischievously. Decades later, the music producer will be convicted of murdering his girlfriend at his California mansion. In the fall of 1980, John Lennon is just beginning to plan his return to the spotlight. He'd been spending the past few years mostly in seclusion, raising his son Sean with his wife Yoko in their opulent penthouse at the Dakota, a high-security luxury apartment building overlooking Central Park. John had been hiding not only from the oppressive weight of fame, but also from terrorists. In 1977, while the Son of Sam was executing lovers in parked cars, igniting terror across New York, John was living in his own personal hellscape. He'd been holed up in the Dakota, writing the songs that would eventually become his final album, Double Fantasy, and enjoying time being a dad. He'd never been big on heavy security, even after becoming the target of an FBI investigation. But all that changed when he received an ominous and terrifying letter. His housekeeper handed him an envelope. John opened it and read it. The letter states, "We are the terrorists from the FALN Puerto Rican Independence Movement. This letter is a positive threat to your life. We demand that you leave $100,000 in a strong package with the clerk at the front entrance of the Dakota House. If you do not meet our demands, your loved ones will be kidnapped and killed. You have exactly 9 days from the date of this letter to decide and to get the money. Do not call the FBI or the police. Don't play any tricks with us, because we are good and prepared for it. Don't forget, the FBI cannot protect your family forever, but you can be sure that we will be in every corner." John's blood ran cold. Despite the warning, he called the FBI, which began an investigation. The Bureau parked two agents in a car across the street from the Dakota. Their presence gave John a small bit of comfort.
Lennon is furious and scared. He doesn't know how he should handle the situation, so he contacts the FBI, the government agency that had placed him under surveillance and nearly ruined his life just a few years before. The feds begin to investigate with Lennon's blessing. Agents search the Bureau's anonymous letter file for possible matches, and they examine the envelope for clues, including fingerprints and watermarks. Federal agents also interview all 22 employees working at the Dakota, concerned that the threat might be coming from within. There are also strict policies in place for anyone entering the building. An unmarked car carrying two undercover FBI agents parks across the street from the Dakota, and this time, Lennon welcomes it. He's relieved at the sight. Agents soon notice a suspicious man sitting in a green Chevy parked in front of the Dakota. They step out of their unmarked car, cross the street, and flash their badges against the driver's window. "What are you doing here?" one agent asks. "Waiting for John Lennon." "What do you want with Mr. Lennon?" "I'd like to get a picture of him for my wife," the man says. The agents demand to see the guy's driver's license, and they take down his information before ordering him to shove off. The driver has no prior record and isn't affiliated with any terror organization. He's just another nosy fan who's hungry for a glimpse of the rock idol.
Six more extortion letters follow from December 1977 to March 1978. The letters are followed by another phone call to Lennon's home. This time, John answers the phone. "You blew it," the caller says before hanging up. The FBI learns that the threatening letters are being mailed from a post office in Jamaica, New York. When agents arrive, they interview a clerk who remembers a dark-skinned man mailing something to John Lennon just a few days before. The clerk figures it's just a piece of fan mail. In that particular letter, the group has threatened to storm the Dakota and to shoot anyone who stands in their way. Also tucked into the envelope is a drawing of a hand grenade, accompanied with the word Terrorismo. The postal clerk remembers that the unknown mailer also wore a dark blue overcoat, a black fur hat, and wire-rimmed glasses. A sketch artist creates a composite, and agents rush it over to the Dakota. John takes a close look. Is this the man who's been threatening his family and keeping him on edge? "I'm sorry. I've never seen this person before," Lennon tells the agents in frustration. One final letter follows. This time, the aspiring extortionist, with poor grammar, tells Lennon that the terror group is giving up on their attempts to force him to pay $100,000 to ensure the safety of his family. "The group only want you to be a part of our war. That means you will all blow up somewhere, and then they will send a letter to the FBI claiming responsibility for the act." For John Lennon, this threat means he can no longer stroll freely around the city that he loves with Sean and Yoko. It means that he'll be looking over his shoulder no matter where he goes. It means that it's no longer safe to go outside. Lennon hires a retired FBI agent to be his family's bodyguard. He'll never be truly at ease again. The agent's name is Doug McDougal, and he's just retired after 24 years working as a special agent for the FBI in New York City. He's built like a linebacker and made to look even more intimidating by the revolver bulging out of his jacket. "We're looking to hire a bodyguard," Yoko says. "After the extortion attempt, we feel we may be somewhat vulnerable." "I've read up on your case," McDougal points out. "My background is counterintelligence and espionage. I used to hunt Soviet spies for a living." "And that makes you qualified for this job?" Lennon asked. "Yes, sir. I study patterns. I see things that shouldn't be there. I can protect your family." "Just protect Sean," John corrects him. "We just need you to protect the boy." "With all due respect, you're one of the most famous people in the world. You need protection yourself." "They didn't kidnap Getty, did they?" John counters. "Instead, they took his grandson, cut off his ear, and sent it back in an envelope." "We just want to ensure Sean's safety." "I can handle the job if that's what you need," McDougal says confidently.
The Beatles had been dead for 5 years, but Paul McCartney and John remained on mostly friendly terms. In 1976, Paul and his wife Linda stopped by the Dakota, smoked some pot with John, and then went out to eat at New York's famous eatery, Elaine's, which was just a few blocks from the Dakota. After dinner, they retired back to the Dakota and watched Saturday Night Live together. They were stunned when the show's producer, Lorne Michaels, appeared on the screen and made an offer to them on live TV to perform a reunion set on the show.
"Hi, I'm Lorne Michaels, the producer of Saturday Night. But please allow me, if I may, to address myself to four very special people. John, Paul, George, and Ringo, the Beatles. The National Broadcasting Company has authorized me to offer you a certified check for $3,000. Here it is. Can we get a close-up of this, Dave? Which camera is it on? Now here it is. As you can see, verifiably, it is a check made out to you, the Beatles, for $3,000. All you have to do is sing three Beatle tunes. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's $1,000 right there. You know the words, it'll be easy. Like I said, this is made out, this check here is made out to the Beatles. You divide it any way you want. If you want to give Ringo less, that's up to you.
Little did Michaels know, John and Paul were watching together and thought about heading over to the studio at Rockefeller Center to give a surprise performance. Paul, in an interview for our book, recalled the surreal moment. It came on TV and John asked if I knew about this, Paul told us. I didn't, as I had been in the UK. For a moment, we thought we might run down to the TV studio, but we decided it was too much like work and that it would be more fun to have the night off. It's too bad because it would have been historic, and there wouldn't be many more chances for the two to play together ever again.
Mark David Chapman grew up in a dysfunctional family. He grew up a huge Beatles fan, but as he got older, he became obsessed with John Lennon. He thought John was a phony, and he was angry about his comment that the Beatles were bigger than Jesus. A devout Christian, Chapman had been a huge Beatles fan his whole life, but hearing that his hero had made such a blasphemous remark, he destroyed his Beatles records. Imagine that John Lennon is dead, he would sing. He jumped from job to job, dabbled in drugs, and was homeless for a spell. He did some missionary work overseas, got married to a Japanese woman who looked just like Yoko, and wound up working as a security guard in Honolulu. He hated his job, was drunk much of the time, and was miserable in his personal and professional life. Mark David Chapman was a lost soul. He attempted suicide. He made a list of people he was considering killing. That list included Orson Welles, James Taylor, Todd Rundgren, President Carter, Johnny Carson, and even Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. But he kept coming back to John Lennon. While we were researching this book, we pulled the entire case file for the Chapman case. We traveled to the Manhattan Criminal Court on Center Street in New York City, and we had to put in a written request to have the case file retrieved from the archives in upstate New York in Albany. We waited for weeks until we finally got a call from the clerk telling us that the file had arrived and that we could review it. We went down to the stately Manhattan courthouse, told the clerk our names, and we asked for the file. We had no idea what to expect. The clerk went to the back room and came back with a file filled with folders and documents. Dave and I dug into these files, and we were stunned with what we found. There were hundreds of pages of transcribed interviews and reports from sessions between Chapman and a variety of psychologists and psychiatrists. They gave a disturbing look into his tormented mind. In one letter, he talked about his battles with alcohol in the days before he flew to New York with his gun. There I was, a big nothing, all washed up, Chapman said. My life went steadily downhill. My life corrupted into bits of dry matter, into nothing.
John Lennon had put his rock star days behind him when his son Sean was born in 1975. He took up sailing and had a life-altering experience during a voyage from Newport, Rhode Island to Bermuda. He and a crew of three, led by John's sailing instructor, sailed directly into a massive storm. While the crew battled severe nausea, John took the wheel and steered the ship through driving rain and crashing waves. The sound of thunder cracks like a whip as flashes of lightning illuminate the skies. It's now the moment of truth for John, and more frightening than anything he's experienced before. This isn't like having your body filled with nerves as you take the stage in front of thousands of fans. This time, lives are at stake, including his own. John fights through the fear as he wages war with the paralyzing storm. A huge wave breaches the bow and rolls like a freight train in his direction at the helm. He grips the wheel and is knocked down by a wave. Lennon pulls himself up and shakes his fist at the sky. "Take me away, God," he yells. "I don't give a shit. I'm a Viking." The worry and anxiety drain from Lennon's body. He's now been baptized by the storm and grows more confident with each massive wave and each desperate hour. The world's most famous musician and most inexperienced sea captain guides the vessel for 6 grueling hours, cutting through the imposing gale and over the treacherous crests of the Bermuda Triangle.
It's a landmark moment for John Lennon. He realizes 2 things. He wants to be there for his family, and he wants to get back to creating music for the world. He writes his 1980 album, Double Fantasy, over the ensuing months, composing much of it on a gorgeous white grand piano in his great room inside the Dakota. On December 7th, 1980, Mark David Chapman moves from the Upper West Side YMCA and checks into the Sheraton Center Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. He takes the subway from the hotel to the Dakota. Emerging from the subway station on East 72nd Street, Chapman encounters singer James Taylor. "I'm a musician, just like you," Mark says. "I have something that I need to get to John Lennon. You know him, right?" Taylor sees something that's off with the young man. Chapman's eyes are dilated, and Chapman's unnerved. "I gotta go, man," Taylor says. Chapman wanders into an art gallery and sees comedian Leslie Nielsen and actor Robert Goulet. He actually gets his picture taken with Goulet. He walks over to the Dakota and asks the doorman if John Lennon is around. "I really don't know. I think he might be out of town," the doorman says. "Do you mind if I wait and see?" Chapman asks. "Well, it's a public sidewalk." Chapman, clutching his copy of Double Fantasy, waits for hours, but Lennon never shows up. Chapman then goes home, and he pays an escort $200 to go up to his room with him. They talk, and they give each other massages, but they do not have sex. After the woman leaves, Chapman calls his wife Gloria in Hawaii, and he tells her that he loves her. He then grabs a New Testament Bible off the nightstand, and he turns to the Gospel according to John. He takes out a red pen, and he adds the word Lennon.
The next morning, December 8th, 1980, Chapman wakes up early and arranges several items into a bizarre display on the dresser. He puts pictures of himself doing missionary work with children, a letter of commendation from one of his former work supervisors, a Todd Rundgren 8-track album, a picture from The Wizard of Oz, his passport, and the Bible, open to the page that reads, "The Gospel According to John, Lennon." He looks himself in the mirror and says, "I'm no longer Mark Chapman. I'm Holden Caulfield now." It's a reference to the disaffected outcast anti-hero in the J.D. Salinger novel, The Catcher in the Rye. Mark puts on a trench coat and scarf and grabs his .38 revolver. He slides it into the pocket of the coat. He stands in front of the mirror and crouches into a shooting position. He pulls the gun out and points it at himself in the mirror. He stops, takes one more look around the room, exits, and heads down to the lobby. He stops into a shop that has a small collection of books for sale. He scours the shelf until he finds a paperback copy of The Catcher in the Rye. He purchases it, goes outside, opens it, and writes inside, "To Holden Caulfield from Holden Caulfield. This is my statement, The Catcher in the Rye."
Coming up on The Last Days of John Lennon, Part 2, Casey and Dave bring you back to the Upper East Side in 1980 and into the investigation of the killing of the iconic Beatle with exclusive new details and interviews. Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers is a joint production of Mudhouse Media and Fort Point Media. This episode is brought to you with thanks to our sponsor, Work Local in Marshfield, Massachusetts. Music in this episode was provided by Chris Spagone. For more on the Mudhouse Media Podcast Network, visit mudhousemedia.com. That's Mudhouse with two D's. And for the latest updates on their podcast and all of the writing and film projects of Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge, please visit fortpointmedia.com.